A man walks into POP Fishing and Marine and he stands, staring and still. After a few minutes, the heavy perfection of machined metal speaks to him, and he reaches out his hand to a shiny chrome jethead trolling lure. This man owns no boat. He owns no fishing rod, no reel. But he picks up the chrome jethead fishing lure and carries it to the register, where he stands proudly. The woman at the register knows this man does not fish, but she smiles. She comes out from behind the counter, and she leads him across the store to the display of big green egg cookers. He reaches out his hand, and he lays it on the finely engineered top of an extra-large-sized big green egg. Suddenly, his face gains back the faraway look of a man who has been called by something powerful, and he turns to the woman from the sales desk, and he says, "I have an enormous backyard." POP Fishing and Marine. You want stuff that works? We got it. On Pier 38, next to Nico's.
You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Yeah, as we continue along here, our Thanksgiving weekend, glad to have you with us no matter where you are. We're giving thanks for a lot of things, and it's time to talk about the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council. And one of the things that they do in behind their little closed doors, which is kind of a secret for most of the time, is they produce copious works and reports and all kinds of stuff based on their research and observations. And we're going to talk about that a little today. We've got some of the stakeholders with us, and we're going to introduce you to them one by one. But first, we're going to talk to Josh Jamello, because I think, you know, sometimes in our regular workaday world, Josh, we don't realize the impact of the work we do. And I know that that's kind of true of the council in some respects, because there's a lot of people listening to the show. They have no clue what the council's gist of the work is. It's more than just keeping track on how many tuna get caught. You guys are big. What are these annual reports? What satisfaction is there at the end of every calendar year that we come up with all these reports?
Well, these annual reports actually provide a status of our fisheries. Mm-hmm. And this is something that we can go to Congress or to the National Marine Fisheries Service and tell them, hey, look, this is what our fisheries look like. We're going to either need help or here's something to celebrate and give something back to the fishermen so that they know what's going on.
Is it safe to assume that a lot of this is to satisfy the fact that these organizations that you give these reports to are funding you? And what happens is they want to know they're getting bang for their buck. So they want to see what happened in the last 12 months or 18 months or whatever it is, whatever period of time the report covers.
Right. So the council is funded through Congress. So this is basically a report back to Congress saying, hey, this is what's going on with our fisheries. This is where your money's being spent.
But they like to get their money's worth. So they're going to be eyeballing this thing and say, wow, that's great. You know, that's good. This is a tool that was worth it.
And it also provides us a way to measure the management measures and how we've been doing with management, and also to use as the data repository for some of our amendments.
When, just out of curiosity, because we're going to speak to everybody that was involved in these various reports, but obviously you have to have an instruction manual or a goal to set. I mean, you know, so how is that determined? I mean, outside of that, you have certain federal agencies that want to know, let's say, about how sustainable is tuna fishing in the Pacific? That's a pretty good one, right? But what about some of the other things? What causes their need?
A lot of it comes from the mandates of the Magnuson-Stevens Act. A lot of it, or the rest of it, actually comes from our fishery ecosystem plan. It directs us on what we need to look at as far as management measures are concerned and the species. But it also can come from other places, such as the National Marine Fisheries Service, on the needs for them to do their science as well.
Okay, now let's get into it. First of all, Asuka Ishizaki has been with us before. Her title at the council is Protected Species Coordinator. And Asuka, one thing that there are a lot of things that happened in the last year which are kind of cool. When we realized that some species maybe weren't as threatened as they were, and then some are. How does that shift on an annual basis? Is it measurable what we have to keep an eye on?
Yeah, we definitely keep a track on that, that what species are listed and protected under the Endangered Species Act, how their status is, really affects the way that our fisheries are managed, especially the Hawaii longline fishery has heavily been managed for protected species impacts.
Yeah, and that's really good, because don't we set an example internationally?
Absolutely. Yeah, we've talked about it many times on this show about how great our Hawaii longline fishery is in terms of reducing seabird and sea turtle interactions. They are the gold standard.
But you know what I get concerned about, and that is sometimes a fisherman or somebody listening to the show thinks, wow, you mean I can't go fishing this big part of the ocean because they're worried about this left-handed shearwater bird or something. There are ramifications, right, when you identify a species as being, you know, threatened or really, really in bad shape, that you have to protect the whole area. That affects a lot of parts of the fishery.
Yeah, and that's part of the job that the council has and the work that we do with our partner at the NOAA Fisheries, making sure that all of our fisheries are covered under what's called the ESA, Endangered Species Act consultations. It's a fancy way of saying, oh, check to make sure your impacts are okay, so that they can go fishing and continue to fish.
How many different species through the council, through your office, are you looking at the endangered ones? I mean, because I know that everybody can come up and they think monk seal, they think, oh, green sea turtle, hawksbill, loggerhead. Aren't there a lot of species that we really have to manage?
We do, especially in the longline fishery. We track sea turtle interactions, seabird interactions, marine mammals interactions. In each of those categories, there's multiple species.
Right, so there's a lot.
There's definitely a lot, and that's part of the reason why we pulled in a new chapter into the annual report. We have a full chapter now on each of the annual reports for our plans that cover the protected species, especially the longline fishery. We have a lot of data. All of that data used to reside in multiple reports.
So you have to go to all different reports.
And so now we pulled those all together. And so we have one handy place to go to track and monitor and see what's going on.
How many of these reports either are now available or will be available on the WPCouncil.org website?
Right now, all of our insular reports, four of our reports, so the Hawaii Archipelagic Plan, American Samoa, the Mariana, and the PREA, the Pacific Remote Island Area reports, are all now up on our website. So that's for the 2015 report.
Yeah.
The pelagic one that includes a longline fishery is forthcoming. It's pretty close. Hopefully we'll have it up very soon.
Yeah, and Josh, isn't that something that's really visible? I mean, when people go to the website, you know what their interest is, and more stuff is at wpcouncil.org. And I don't know, but you got to give a tip of the hat to whoever really is the main driver of maintaining that and freshening it up, because it's really grown a lot in the last couple of years.
Yeah, and Lauren over on our staff has been adding a lot of new information to the website, and as these reports come out, it's announced on under the latest news category.
And by the way, gang, we've been remiss, but there's a whole bunch of our shows that are also clicked through from that website. You'll be able to find even some of the pictures that are here. So that being said, Marlo Sabater, we call him Malloy, is a marine ecosystem scientist and comes from a different part of the world, but has been here now for, I guess, more years than I even thought of. 4 or 5 years?
6 years.
6 years. Almost. And for those that don't know, where was home before?
Home is back in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's sort of interesting, because I would imagine that when you were growing up, this was probably the last place you thought you were going to be living.
Definitely, yeah. I never thought of leaving the country, but...
When people look at what you do, I know, for instance, for many, many years, almost everything you find in Hawaii, tourist-related or whatever, was from the Philippines. I mean, just this tremendous amount of river stones and coral and all of this kind of stuff. Has the country sort of realized, okay, it's great that we have all of this stuff, but we got to slow down on some of it because we're depleting?
Yeah, there's a huge difference between Hawaii and back in the Philippines, where you have a lot of people depending on the marine environment for their livelihoods. And if you want to talk about overfishing, that's where it's at.
Yeah, you know, isn't it sort of interesting that here in Hawaii we used to be like that, but as modern as we got, we have big ships full of stuff, we got airplanes full of stuff, there are still parts of the world, including the Philippines, where if you don't fish, you don't eat.
Right.
So, you know, maybe if something is supposed to be 4 inches and it's 3.5 inches, I'm sorry, but I got to eat, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you do? What is the basis of your work today? So you can explain it's not just the fish, it's the whole system that the fish is in. I think a lot of us have trouble, you know, think, why can't you anchor a boat over there? It's going to ruin the reef. What's so important about the reef?
So there's a lot of linkages between the health of the ecosystem and the fishery itself. Mm-hmm. So fishery is just one factor that affects the marine environment, especially the nearshore environment.
Yeah.
And you've got pollution and, you know, climate-driven changes in the environment.
Isn't it sort of interesting that a lot of times the council's work is thought to be pelagic surface-running game fish that are away from the islands? And that there is this working relationship that exists between state and local governments and the council. So a lot of people that say, well, I never go catch my mice, so what do I care about the council? Well, it gets right into the estuaries and to the wetlands and everything, right?
Right. So the council has this mandate to manage the fisheries, or at least analyze the status of the fisheries through the full range of its full range of the stock, which includes the nearshore environment.
Yeah.
That's why when we do our analysis in this SAFE report, it includes not only the pelagic realm or the from 3 to 200 nautical miles, but it should also include information from 0 to 3. So when we do our stock assessments, it should cover the whole range of the stock.
And you know, not just you're in the field federal. A lot. From what you guys do, you guys get in the field a fair bit. I want the reaction of people that realize when they malama something, when they take care of it, or when they stop doing whatever was making it go downhill, how quickly Mother Nature can sometimes turn things around. Is that ultimately at the end of what your goals are, to report something that may be out of line and maybe either adjudicate rules or make policies or increase penalties or consequences if you continue to violate?
Right. It's interesting in the process of compiling information for this annual/stock assessment and fishery evaluation report, mm-hmm. that when you look at the trends of catch, CPUE, and effort, you would see some steep increase and decrease, mm-hmm. over time, and it's kind of interesting to look at that, those peaks and troughs. Mm-hmm. That you can almost interpret it with some external factor affecting those trends. Some mm-hmm. some of which are hurricane related, some of which are socioeconomic related kind of thing.
I was going to ask you about that, because we've talked before when I've had the pleasure in the last couple of years of being the host of the Fishers Forums. And when you talk about these new things like effort and everything else, a whole bunch of people in the audience are thinking, what are you talking about? They're learning about these things. They're getting more sophisticated in the way you manage or do these stats, right? I mean, travel time is not the issue. It's what the effort is when you get to the fishing grounds. Explain maybe how that's changed and what a fisherman has to do to be more forthcoming with his information.
Yeah, fishing effort can be defined in multiple ways, one of which is fishing effort can be on a trip level. Mm-hmm. It can be number of hours fished, or even number of gears that was deployed. Mm-hmm. So we really have to be specific.
Yeah.
Right, a lot of variables to consider, and we have to be specific in the way we report our fishing effort depending on the nature of the fisheries. Like for bottom fish, for mm-hmm. example, a lot of the bottom fish fishermen felt that trip level fishing effort does not really represent what's going on in the fishery, but that's the information that's being collected through the state data collection system. But what's more reflective is the number of hours that you have your hook in the water.
Yeah, so doesn't that sort of tweak the way we've been doing things to a point where the information becomes more valuable?
Right, we have to be aware of those nuances mm-hmm. in the data set, so that the information represented in the annual SAFE reports are truly reflective of the fishery.
What are some of the things that you could share with us as far as the marine ecosystems reports that you've been working on this year that are now finished? What have we learned?
So the annual SAFE report now has a bunch of ecosystem considerations in mm-hmm. it. We added, as Asuka said, protected species. We have habitat. We have climate change mm-hmm. variables in the report. And also, we have ecosystem variables in the report. We report on information that was collected by the Science Center on fish biomass through mm-hmm. their research crews. And also we have summaries of the mean length of fish that occurs in the market, and also the life history variables that the life history program in the Science Center collects. So we know the age of fish, how fast they grow, at what size and age are they sexually mature. So we summarize all those information in the report. So now we have all the information we need to interpret the fishery performance based on the ecosystem or the environment they're exposed to.
Yeah, you know, Josh, let me ask you a question before we move on to Becky. And that is, some of these things that we're talking about have a great deal of cooperation that a fisherman must do. I mean, if you show like a reef is repairing itself because we've done this and that. One thing that Malloy just said is really of interest to me, and that is the size of the fish in different places that are being taken. You know, maybe a responsible commercial fisherman on Oahu, if he gets into a school of Oama, he might think, why don't we wait until these are Becky? I don't want to eat Oama. But there are some places, like in other parts of the Pacific, within the council's, you know, purvey, that they're taking fish a lot smaller because they need them. How do these people get told, you got to stop a little bit on this species, or at least at this time of the year, because if they don't breed, you're not going to be any tomorrow?
It all starts with the data. Mm-hmm. What do we know about that fish, and what do we expect to know?
But is the fisherman starting to grasp not just the importance of the data, but buy into what the data is suggesting, based on, it's not just somebody coming from Washington, D.C. and putting a mask in the water and saying that we have a shortage?
Do they understand?
Do they get it? In other words, can they use this information to sort of guide what they're going to catch and when they're going to catch it?
For the most part, you probably could. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could look at the data and see what the trends are, which fish seem to have a better stock.
Yeah.
But you have to be careful with that, because you also have to know what else is going on in the fishery, and that's something that we're going to be working on next week and trying to interpret those trends with other factors besides fishing.
Yeah, by the way, that's just a teaser on next week's show when Josh and I get together and say, okay, we got all of these reports. Now, what do they mean? Our next guest is Becky Walker. She is a fisheries analyst, and we're talking about habitat and marine planning. And I think that maybe this is kind of interesting, because I guess what sometimes thought of you, okay, Becky, you got to produce this report. What is it that your reports do? What have you been working on?
So I'll start with habitat.
Mm-hmm.
And for the habitat section, the council is required to define essential fish habitat for each of the managed fisheries.
Mm-hmm.
And so for bottom fish, there's a certain water column and substrate definition. So for bottom fish, it's the entire water column and the substrate out to about 400 meters. And so that entire area is considered essential habitat. Mm-hmm. And
now, where is that line between what's inshore and what's bottom fishing? You know, but they on the mainland, they call it, they don't understand us, they call it ground fish. We call it bottom fish, because usually the bottom is a little bit deeper.
Well, okay, so for the habitat definition, there's not an inshore offshore line, because we're required to define it for all life stages of the bottom fish.
Okay.
And so when it's larval, it's kind of floating.
Yeah.
Floating all
who
around.
Who knows, right? It certainly doesn't know where it is.
Yeah, and it's also defined for all of the bottom fish species. So, for example, juvenile paca, they actually come pretty shallow and hang out over sandy flats, sandy areas. There's a spot in Kaneohe Bay that's a nursery ground just off of Kaneohe Bay.
I bet people are so surprised when one way or another they catch one of them, whether it's in a net or on hooks. Wow, that's a paca. How are they really like little fingerlings in size? Or they get bigger? Anybody know, Malloy?
Well, they probably get bigger once they go to the adult habitat.
Yeah.
But for the near shore areas, they're probably sighted at like around, I don't know, maybe how's this, like 40 centimeters.
Yeah, you know, but I think what's interesting is if anybody's ever caught a baby mahi mahi by accident, they say, that doesn't look, it's the same color as a mahi mahi, but it doesn't look like one. Is that paca identifiable? Can you tell it's a paca?
It's kind of hard to identify what a red fish is. A red fish.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. but that, I think maybe, Becky, that's what I'm getting at. It's sort of interesting to me that, you know, when you have a job description, you got to go out and do something. You must be saying, okay, that's great, I love to do this, but what's going to happen to my work after it's done?
So that's something. So we're supposed to define the essential fish habitat, and through the annual report process, we're supposed to update it. And so that's by, in this report, adding in the habitat section, we're revitalizing that process. And so for this last report, what you can find available on the website is the beginning of a precious corals review. Mm-hmm. So that's another fishery. And
let me interrupt for a bit, because people a lot of times don't get that. I grew up a black coral diver, so I mean, I knew about fishing and coral. To me, it was the same thing. They're both coming out of the ocean. We just didn't eat the black coral. We sold it to somebody who wanted to buy it. But a lot of us are like that, right? And you see that in the fishery. One guy, he might go catch aquarium fish at certain times of the year, and he might be a mullet guy at the rest of the time of the year. So this black coral thing shouldn't be surprising that it's a resource out of the ocean, right? We got to keep track of it.
Yeah.
Or any precious coral, I should say.
Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about those is there's been a lot more, not a lot more studies, but a few more studies looking at the distribution of the deep water corals. Mm-hmm. And so for this EFH review, the way that that fishery is managed, once you have a certain density of a bed, you can establish that as a bed and then put in... define it as essential fish habitat and estimate the harvest capacity of that particular bed.
Yeah, I was
going to
ask you that. Are there people sophisticated enough to say, okay, that's a bed of pink coral, and we can take so much of it, and it grows at this rate, and we can pretty much go back there if we somehow regulate? In other words, nobody wants to have a regulation or a rule, but at what point in time do they wake up and say, okay, I'll buy into that as long as everybody follows it?
That's the idea of the precious corals fishery management plan, estimating the growth rates as well as they can and the density of all of the corals on the bed.
Let's take a look at something that maybe people don't think about for just a minute. I don't even know if you entertain this. Let's take black coral, for instance. Everybody knows it looks like a weed, you know. And Josh, let's get you on this particular one. It looks like a weed, okay? But and we don't eat it, but we sell it to people. It's hard to say, well, I know where some is, but what about if people all of a sudden knew, if it's really a baby, first of all, you don't get much money for it, and secondly, what purpose does it solve? It's not just there to create value in the jewelry industry. What are some of those, what we call precious coral, what are they good for? What do they do?
And that's some of the questions that we ask with our ecosystem and ecological kind of questions, and for black coral, it provides habitat sometimes for smaller fish. There's also other species that take over the black coral. Other corals like bamboo coral is usually the host for something like gold coral that grows over them.
Once you know these things, you become not just a stakeholder, but a part of the process. In other words, the more you know, the more you know. I mean, you know what to take and maybe when to take it, hopefully.
Well, and you know what size is a good size to take it at, both for jewelry or for another curio size or something. You know, don't take the small ones because they don't reproduce until they're this big.
And by the time you get them back to the place and they dry them out, you can't make anything out of them. They're just too small.
Right, yeah. and you sometimes can't even tell what it is underwater when you finally dry it out.
The jewelry people are magic with that, but I do know that probably, Becky, it's way more than just this is a pink coral bed or that is a. It's I think that all of us, and I hope that the people listening, they go to wpcouncil.org and figure this out, is that we really do have like a house of cards, and if any part of it gets out of whack, everything part of it gets out of whack. So what? What are some of the things that your studies would motivate a call to action for, from one year to the next?
Well, I think for that one, I'll talk about marine planning because you were talking about a house of cards. So for that part of the report, we look at what other human actions are going on in the environment that affects fisheries.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for instance, what's included in the annual report is anything that is a multi-year planning horizon, like some of the military activities. Mm-hmm. They'll take 4 years to release a final environmental impact statement. Also,
it's a long time.
It's NEPA is a very long process. And the floating wind farms, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, those potential wind leases. And a lot of times in the when there's an environmental impact statement published, that means that there's a significant environmental impact. And so what we've included where relevant is if there's something in the agency's record of decision that says this will be the impact. Mm-hmm. I will keep track of it in the annual report because we're required as well to look at the cumulative impact of all the fishery actions.
Yeah. It sounds like it's very, very complex. And I know that it, because it is. I mean, you know, it can't be anything more complex. We can go into outer space. We don't know about the ocean. So I guess that the light at the end of the tunnel, if you will, or the accomplishment of all of the different reports that all of you do is, gives it's like a brand new tool set if you learn how to use them. So how do people ramp up to that kind of thing? For instance, what you're doing now, you certainly probably weren't thinking 10 years ago that's what you're going to be doing, right?
No,
I mean, what expectation or what level of expectation or job accomplishment do you get out? Do you expect and get out of this kind of work?
Well, to me, it's really about managing the fishery. Mm-hmm. And carrying forth the Magnuson-Stevens Act.
Yeah.
We're looking at adding
which is our mission, right?
That's our mission. Yeah. Yeah. Looking at all of these different aspects that we haven't necessarily considered as well but as much before, or it was more difficult to access, the habitat issues, the protected species issues, and climate change. In light of the performance of the fishery, it just sheds more light on how the actual management measures are performing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, I think that when you take a look at the big picture, once again, Josh, I got to ask you this because there's a lot of people that, you know, they know where you guys' office is and they know what you say, Magnuson-Stevens, they kind of know about it. But I think the thing that keeps people motivated is knowing that somebody is going to react to the fruits of your labor. In other words, all of these reports, okay, we're done. We're going to start next year's, but we don't even know if everybody's going to like this year's. How do you measure that? How do you sort of quantify that you're getting the job done?
That's always been the problem. Yeah. I mean, how do you know if the job is well done?
Mm-hmm.
I think for us, it's always been people can still fish. We're still fishing. We're not mm-hmm. going anywhere. We're not shutting down fishermen. We're not closing off areas or reducing quotas. If we can keep that level of fishing going, that's what we always want to do. Mm. Like Kitty says, our motto should always be fish forever.
Yeah, I love that. I got one of those t-shirts. Asuka, I want to go back to the protected species for a minute because there are some people that don't know what comprises why one of these species gets put to that list. In other words, what is the ideal amount? Let's address one that I know you know about, and those are the mammals, the monk seal. We've seen on the main Hawaiian islands, they seem to be pretty healthy. And we've seen in the monument of Papahanaumokuakea that they're kind of damp, they're kind of threatened. How do we use the information that we have in the main islands to go help those poor monk seals that are dying in the monument?
Yeah, and that's a conundrum, the monk seal conundrum, as we always say. Why, you know, do they continue to decline in a protected area? And I think that's something that the NOAA fisheries folks have been trying to figure out, and something that's really done under the Endangered Species Act and not so much under the fisheries anymore. Because from the way that we look at it, we've dealt with the monk seal issue 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, as soon as this council came into play, monk seal was one of the first things that was dealt with. And so I think we do our part in minimizing the impacts where we can, and, you know, continue to be involved in that process. And wherever the fishery can help to help the recovery of the endangered species, we do. And that's what we've always done with the monk seals, the turtles. We're working on that with false killer whales
too. As a specialist in that area, let's talk about maybe there's this big apex predator problem in that part of the ocean that seems to be, does it sometimes, it would seem like the planet levels itself off somewhere. In other words, if they eat a bunch of monk seals and they run out of eating monk seals, they're going to eat something else or they're not going to die, or they're going to die. I mean, you know, it does it self-manage? You know why I ask that? Because I know it's a different. I ask that because we have seen natural extinction of species on this planet since the beginning of time. Who knows if we backed up something that we wouldn't have a Tyrannosaurus Rex somewhere. But in fact, aren't we just always changing a little bit?
Now you're getting into philosophy.
Yeah.
But I think there is certainly an environmental and oceanographic component to the whole monk seal and story that we don't quite understand. And one of the things that we're seeing is that that decline in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands is starting to stop.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be coinciding with the big decadal 10-year, every 10-year or so oceanographic shifts. Mm-hmm. And so there's probably a factor of that. How much of that influences food availability for the monk seals themselves? How much of that, you know, influence food availability for the ulua and the sharks and everything else that competes with the monk seal? We don't quite understand. And so that's the, you know, the really tricky factor.
I wouldn't
want
to be a lobster in that area because they get really nervous, I think. Now that we're not taking them, somebody else is. Right?
Exactly. But even the lobster thing too, you know, there was this big theory that it was the fishery that was causing the decline of the lobster, and we know now that it probably wasn't. And we also know now that, you know, lobster wasn't a big component of the monk seal's diet either. And so as we continue to do studies, we continue to do research, we refine the way that we think about the ecosystem, and we can refine the way that we do management. And that's exactly what we do in our fisheries too. And these reports really help in looking at the data on an annual basis, encouraging more research to be done to help us answer these questions, bring that back, put it back into our management, and help inform the council and
I'm guessing that you guys, that this year is like a blink of an eye, you know, and to the people outside, oh, annual, that's plenty. We look at it annually. Well, these just, they seem to, for all of us, they're going by pretty quickly, right? I want to go back to Marlo Sabater. Malloy, you know, with his background in the Philippines and now doing this work here on the ecosystem, I would say that there was rampant, you know, ignoring of the ecosystem for a long time in that part of the ocean. Is what you learned when you were there coming here, do you see the same sort of decline or repair? How can we compare the two areas?
It's really about the difference in perspective. Mm-hmm. And coming from a developing country, you would see boats in the water like 24/7. Mm-hmm. You can almost count how many boats are out there fishing at a certain period. And if you compare those numbers here, the numbers here are way less.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, look at our longline fleet. There's only like 130, 40 boats in it, right?
Exactly.
Not thousands.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So you know, coming into Hawaii with that perspective, with that difference in you know, in the scale of the fishery, I think helps a lot. And you know, Hawaii is lucky to you know, for its fishery to be almost self-regulating.
Yeah.
It could be triggered by various factors why it's self-regulating in a developing country where, you know, a lot of people are depending on the ocean for its even just for subsistence.
Mm-hmm. It's very difficult.
The pressure is always high.
I was going to say it must be almost impossible there to feel guilty, because it's not guilty. It's this is what you do. You know, I mean, and here we can put some teeth in the laws and put some consequences on people that break the rules. Is that a major difference, just societal difference?
Yeah, that's a major societal difference. Mm-hmm. But one thing is common between the two areas is that enforcement is really a huge thing that people are having trouble dealing with. And
well, if you talk to our guys here, our fishing game guys, dual board guys, everything, their job is almost impossible. It's just so large and so big and so looming. And you know, how do you control from the mountaintops to the sea in one guy in a Jeep, right?
Right. And then you multiply that by 100 times if you go to a developing country.
Yeah. Wow. Big deal. Let's go back, though, to Becky for a minute. The main gist of your work this year was what?
Well, this was the first year we put habitat and marine planning in the report.
In the same report, right? Yeah, that's what I thought.
So the main gist was, what can we start with? With the understanding that we would iteratively improve this report over the next 5 or so years. I would imagine, actually, that 5 years, we would keep improving it after 5 years. But just really getting the process in place to produce those two sections.
You know, I think if I just on a personal basis, I do know that when you identify something as needing a certain amount of time to probably be more valuable, it must be sort of difficult for everybody to say, I don't know if I can make that commitment. I don't know. I'm going to get married, or I'm going to go here, or I'm going to go there, or I'm going to do these other things. I think because the council is a bottom up organization, that you can easily pass along the baton. In other words, you don't want to see if somebody has to leave or something happens to somebody and they can't do their work anymore, who's going to pick it up?
Yeah, that was part of developing the process, mm-hmm. actually, so that all of the work on this, we can switch it not only between council staff, but also between plan team members and the Pacific Island Fisheries Science Center. So developing a standard operating procedure for each of these, like if there's a lot of data that we're pulling together.
Yeah. I think that's the key. And Josh, we talk about this a lot. Got to go back to this for a minute so people really sort of understand. You and I have often talked about technology being both good and bad, but mostly in the respect of gathering information, it's pretty good. And a lot of us fishermen are buying into it, but it must be that the completion of these reports on a timely basis actually gives somebody something to measure. I don't know how often a fisherman measures something, but certainly a fisherman with a mortgage measures whether he's catching enough fish or allowed to catch enough fish to pay his mortgage. So what do you see as the end result of all these reports going forward as to help us even more, particularly because of technology, to share the information and to act on it?
I think a major thing for us is going to be to find out what we don't know,
mm-hmm.
you know, yeah. the known knowns and the known unknowns mm-hmm. and the unknown unknowns, all that stuff. For us, it's what are the gaps in our knowledge that we can identify, and in the next year we can start targeting to try and fill some of those gaps. We probably won't be able to get to all of them as quick sometimes, as we'd like to.
Sometimes don't you have to go upstairs and say, you know what, we've discovered a need here, but we're going to need somebody to come and do this. What are we going to do?
Right, and that goes back to trying to fill that need mm-hmm. with either resources mm-hmm. or maybe a new method mm-hmm. Of capturing that data.
Yeah. You know, Asuka, real quickly on you, I know that one of the things that happens in the longline fishery, which we talked about earlier, is that there's an observer program. And this is unique in many parts of many fisheries. How valuable is it that these people are on these things? And I'm not saying keeping people honest, but I'm saying just reporting, just giving enough. You never know when an observer is going to be on your boat, right? You got to go. Unless it's a shutome, a sword fishing boat, then they always have them. But how good is that stuff with the kind of work that you do to identify, okay, this is what we expected and this is what happens on these trips?
Yeah, it's vital. Mm-hmm. It's critical to the monitoring of the longline fishery, especially since, you know, we have these sea turtle measures, seabird mm-hmm. measures, and we need to know if those are still effective. And so we can mm-hmm. track over time, are those numbers still low?
Yeah.
Are they going up? If they're going up, why are they going up? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, without that observer data constantly coming in and coming in at that same amount of level or, you know, with good coverage, we can't do that. We can't monitor that on a near real-time basis. And so it certainly helps with keeping the fishery transparent mm-hmm. and the management transparent and continuing to adapt that management so we can do
better. Yeah, you
know,
because I often talk about we do a lot of stuff on Wicked Tuna North and South and Outer Banks and all of this stuff, and they have this thing that comes down like a guillotine. When it's finally, boom, it's over. And they know that. They expect it. They work with it. They live with it. Aren't we sort of developing, or don't we need to develop sort of the same thing here? If we find out that, and we've talked about this before real quickly, we could do a whole program on the green sea turtle, but it used to be part of our diet. And there's a lot of people that want to start eating them again. And it may be happening in the not too distant future, but it looks like that's one that's come back, but not quite enough where science is going to say, okay, we can start eating these guys again or taking them.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a different issue. But even, you know, if hypothetically, if we were able to go in that direction, again, that monitoring and that enforcement, the data collection, all of that is going to be important for the management. Yeah. Otherwise, you can't do a loosey-goosey management. And so it's with any kind of fishery resource or any, you know, resource that you're going to take out and to use for the benefit of the people, you want to have those components, the data collection, the monitoring, the enforcement, and that you can carry across to different sectors.
Okay, so Josh, I know we're not going to grade everybody today with A, B, C, and D, but obviously this is a great time of the year. It's Thanksgiving week. We're giving thanks a lot. It must be that the sense of accomplishment in the council is running high because these guys all have a task to do, they have a deadline to meet, and they're meeting their deadlines.
Yeah, this annual report for this year was a big thing. Mm-hmm. It was a big product that came out of a big meeting, and it took a lot of work by a lot of people, not just the people here, but our partners in the National Marine Fisheries Service, as well as the state of Hawaii and the other island agency fishery departments. But just to have something on paper, especially for coral reef fisheries, which we've been lacking since we started working on coral reef fisheries, basically, to have something in hand to go, look, this is what's happening with your fishery.
Yeah, I think that's great. Well, I certainly want to remind everybody once again that this being Thanksgiving weekend also means that we give thanks to these folks. So just to reintroduce our group and let you know who you've been listening to, Becky Walker is a fisheries analyst, and she's dealing with habitat and marine planning. Marlo Sabater, a marine ecosystem scientist. Malloy's been here now six years. Wow. Just like yesterday. And Asuka Ishizaki. Thank you, Asuka. And Josh, you too. Thanks, everybody. And if you want to know more, you go to wpconsul.org. That's wpconsul.org. It's all there. And we'll see you next time for Go Fish. Have a happy Thanksgiving weekend, everybody. See you next time. Aloha.